Welcome to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and as 2014 draws to a close, it's time to take a look at the year that was with our annual Hall of Fame show. This week, we'll give another listen to some favorite Metro Connection stories from the past year, like the tale of a DC official on a mission to bag non-bag chargers.
I have had some funny instances where a cashier has said, you know, I should be charging you 5 cents, but it's okay. It's on me today.
Plus, we'll remember a civil rights leader who left a larger-than-life impression on his family.
My father would simply demand that we equip ourselves with whatever it takes in order to maintain the rights that we have.
And we'll flash back half a century to the day D.C. first met the lads from Liverpool.
By the time the Beatles came out, it was like you lit a match and the place just went up.
But first, we'll go back to a story we brought you in August, all about the science of the brain. What we experience, what we learn, helps shape our brains. And earlier this year, researchers at Georgetown University Medical Center showed that the language we first learn can affect our brain structure in fascinating ways. But their study wasn't about a person who, say, first learns English versus a person whose native language is French or Russian. No, their research was about a person like, say, this guy.
Hello, my name is Daniel Koo. I'm an associate professor at Gallaudet University in the psychology department.
Koo was born deaf. Here he's using American Sign Language to communicate through interpreter William Kendrick. But ASL was not the first language Koo learned.
I grew up originally in the oral methodology, meaning learning English through lip reading. And later, I learned sign language as a second language.
And that experience, he says, is actually pretty common.
90% of deaf children are born to parents who can hear. So many deaf children use English as their first language, just like I did growing up.
Thing is, though, most studies on deafness have been conducted only with people who use ASL as a first language.
And they never looked at the cross-section of deaf people who are also primarily English users. But we can't assume too many things just from one specific population who grew up in one specific language experience. So we were the first study to really look at both groups of deaf people and compare the structures that are impacted by those language choices that are made developmentally as they are growing up.
And that was a huge revelation for GUMC postdoctoral fellow Olumide Olulade, the study's lead author.
You know, I always thought that, you know, everyone who was deaf used sign language. And to find out that most of the people who are deaf actually grew up using English, I think it's important that, you know, our scientific studies from a scientific perspective provide information that can be used for the full population.
To that end, he explains the research team used magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI, to analyze the brains of four different groups. One,
deaf people who grew up using American Sign Language.
Two,
deaf people who grew up using English or cued speech.
Three,
hearing people who grew up using American Sign Language, which they learned from their deaf parents.
And four,
hearing people who grew up using English.
And what the team found was that with all deaf participants, regardless of their native language, their auditory cortex looked different from their hearing counterparts. Mainly, it had a smaller volume of white matter. That's the tissue affecting how the brain learns and functions.
But what we found is that if you are raised using American Sign Language, you also find some of those differences in the parts of the brain that help us speak or use language.
What Guinevere Eden is speaking of is gray matter, which serves to process information. Eden directs GUMC's Center for the Study of Learning and says the volume of right hemisphere gray matter of deaf native ASL users is thicker than that of deaf native English users. Why? Well, perhaps because the right hemisphere handles visual spatial skills. And with its unique system of grammar, along with its movement of the hands, face, and torso, ASL is more spatial, English more linear.
Now, it doesn't mean that one or the other is better, but I think the interesting question will be when we study things in education, whether it's how we teach reading or whether how we do interventions, it's interesting to have that background information, knowing that it's not just your sensory experience that shapes the brain, but your language experience and that they interact with one another.
That's the biology of learning. And once we understand how learning happens, we can adjust our teaching methods so they'll have the greatest effect. But whatever the method, says Daniel Koo, when it comes to teaching language to a child who's deaf or hard of hearing,
it's important that the deaf child just gets access and has complete access to a language as early as possible, regardless of English or sign language. It's important that they get that developmental exposure.
Because that exposure will help them connect with their world, engage with their community, and perhaps one day teach their children too. For more information on this study and for more resources on providing deaf children with access to language, visit our website, metroconnection.org. We'll head from Georgetown to Southern Avenue Southeast on the border between Washington and Prince George's County. That's where you'll find United Medical Center, D.C.'s only hospital east of the Anacostia River. In its heyday, Greater Southeast, as it was then known, was respected for bringing quality care to an underserved part of the city. But in the nearly 50 years since its opening, the hospital's reputation has sunk. After several bankruptcies and care so haphazard the hospital lost its ability to receive Medicaid reimbursements, the city helped a private company purchase the hospital in 2007. That partnership failed, and in 2010, the city seized ownership and operations. Over the past 4 years, D.C. has spent more than $100 million just to keep UMC's doors open. But as we learned on Metro Connection back in October, the plan for 2015 is a little different.
UMC is reporting that they're not going to need a subsidy this year. So some of the management turnaround that they've had, it seems to be working.
Wes Rivers is a healthcare analyst at the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute. In next year's budget, Huron Consulting, the firm hired to overhaul the hospital, has requested $0 in operating subsidies. Most local politicians agree the city should get out of the hospital business as soon as possible. But it seems the only way out is to get the hospital in better shape. And as Emily Berman tells us, there's still a long way to go.
There's a big sign hanging on the wall at the entrance of United Medical Center's emergency room. It's a picture of a fast-moving train and says, "We're on the change train."
The nurse's station that's here now is older. It's going away in the next couple of months, and this will be completely redesigned.
Dr. Adam Brown is the medical director of the emergency department. Last year, more than 60,000 people visited this emergency room.
Hey, Doc.
Hey, how's it going?
In the next few months, the emergency room will be expanded, and more technology is arriving every day. Things like bedside ultrasound machines and glide scopes to look at patients' airways.
The equipment that we have here to care for patients now, this wasn't in the past, but now is where it should be and is commensurate with what we see at other hospitals.
Wait times used to be 5 or 6 hours from the moment you walked in the door until you saw a doctor. That's no longer the case. 2 years ago, 13% of patients would come in and leave before their name was called. Now, Brown says, the number's down around 5%. Just then, an ambulance arrives. But it's not like on TV. There's no sirens, no one rushing alongside the gurney. At UMC, just because there's an ambulance doesn't necessarily mean it's a life or death emergency.
About 25% of our patients that come to our emergency department come by ambulance, which is a really high number.
There were 15,000 arrivals last year alone.
The patients here, because they have no other way to get to the hospital or they have no one that's taking care of them, to get them to the hospital safely, will use an ambulance for transportation.
And the city, he says, has no program to address it. But it's not just a transportation issue. Many patients use the ER as if it were an urgent care, something UMC is trying to change.
Let's say you had a cough for 3 or 4 days, probably a cold. We see that a lot. They don't know where they could go. They have insurance, but they may not have interacted yet with their primary care physician that's listed on their Medicare or Medicaid card. So we're happy to see them. But when they're discharged, we have them see a patient navigator or a patient concierge. They look at what the complaint was. They look at what the diagnosis was. And then they find, where should that patient go? Should they go to a primary care clinic? Should they go to a pulmonologist? And then they schedule appointments right then with persons within our primary care clinic, because the emergency department's very expensive.
Though the hospital isn't requesting operating funds for the coming year, the city is still handing over $46 million for capital improvements, building renovations, technology, and the creation of 2 new outpatient health centers. Wes Rivers with the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute says he'd like to see a comprehensive plan before any more money is spent on bolstering UMC. Do we need more clinics, more doctors, or just a better system to help people access what's already there? Rivers says it's not clear.
We spend a lot of money on healthcare, so we need to make sure that our capital dollars are spent well. I think there is the efficiency argument, you know, if we keep putting money into a leaky bucket, it's just it's unsustainable, both for us and for the consumers, because the consumers will go to a hospital one day that could be bankrupt and then they don't have a provider.
And the source here are in total focus. So this arm comes down.
On a tour of the radiology department, Chairman Dr. Raymond Tu enthusiastically shows off an array of imaging machines. We stop in a tiny, cold room where UMC has a low-dose mammography machine, which provides the most sensitive test available for breast cancer screenings. Tu says other hospitals in the region don't have it.
We have an emergency department. We have an intensive care unit. We have OBGYN, we have pediatrics, soon oncology, we have orthopedics. In order to use a healthcare system, you'd have to have tools in the toolbox. By providing a really strong radiology department, you will then attract doctors, which I think we've done, who want to practice here in Ward 7 or Ward 8.
At least 35 new doctors have recently started seeing patients at UMC, all different specialties.
We can all have our little cushy jobs elsewhere in the city, but we choose to be here in the rough part of town to provide excellent care for all of our patients.
A few floors above the radiology department is the office of CEO David Small. There are newly laid wood floors, modern furniture, and another one of those change train signs.
We're going somewhere, and we're going there as rapidly as we can get there, and it's everybody needs to be on that change train. I wish it was even faster, but we're making progress.
Little by little, he's fixing up the building. It's old. There are twice as many patient rooms as needed, and not enough space in other areas. The floors need to be waxed by a whole crew of people, and there are a lot of problems with the plumbing. Bad problems.
On the second floor of the hospital, we have our cafeteria and all of our kitchens. They are directly over our operating rooms. If there's any kind of a water problem in our cafeteria, of which in a 50-year-old building we have them, it presents a water infiltration problem in the ORs and forces us to close an OR while we're repairing that.
This past spring, Mayor Gray announced his support for a plan to scrap the building and build a new $330 million hospital in its place. Come January, a new mayor will decide whether this makes sense. In the meantime, Small is cutting costs in other ways, with scrupulous billing and hiring staff internally, not through medical staffing companies. But the most important thing is getting the community to trust UMC and go there for care.
We can talk about financial success, we can talk about cost management, but the biggest issues really are, is the hospital a high-quality organization that has the patient's needs first?
Some people say no. Khadijah Tribble lives two blocks from UMC.
I live in a cul-de-sac of about 63 single-family homes. People who are taxpayers, who work full-time. But my neighbors will say, I'm not going to the hospital. They got too much going on over there.
Even though it's two blocks away.
Tribble was hired by UMC to run a clinic for patients with diabetes, hypertension, HIV, and other chronic diseases. The clinic struggled due to lack of funding and, Tribble says, a hospital with a culture of disrespecting patients.
90% of the folks who come to United Medical Center can't really afford to pay for services, right? But is that why you're in business? Then you picked the wrong hospital to work at. It's a safety net hospital. You come there because you really want to make a difference.
Though UMC is certainly more of an asset towards 7 and 8 now than it was in years past, Tribble says the community deserves better.
It has to stop being a political football where people want to go in and I said this and I did this, and none of that should be important. It's the people. That's what matters.
The hospital may be off life support, she says, but from where she stands, there's a long recovery still ahead. I'm Emily Berman.
After the break, some moments in life can change everything. And this father and daughter know that all too well.
I miss being able to go out in the backyard or go to the park and play with you guys.
But what I love is all the things we can still do.
That and more is just ahead as we continue our walk down the Metro Connection Hall of Fame here on WAMU 88.5.
WAMU News coverage of labor and employment issues is made possible by your contributions and by Matthew Watson, in memory of Marjorie Watson. And support for WAMU 88.5's coverage of the environment comes from the Wallace Genetic Foundation, dedicated to the promotion of farmland preservation, the reduction of environmental toxins, and the conservation of natural resources.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and welcome back to Metro Connection. Today, we're strolling through our annual Hall of Fame and revisiting some of our team's favorite work from the past year. Back in February, Jacob Fenston brought us a story about the challenges of recovering from some pretty serious injuries, like spinal cord damage or amputation. When you've suffered an injury like that, relearning how to do even the most basic of things can be a huge challenge. But what about the not-so-basic things? Jacob Fenston joined some Washingtonians on a trip to Pennsylvania to bring us the answer.
Brandon Bland was injured a little more than a year ago.
I'm able to do a little standing, a little walking with my walker. Like this morning, I brushed my teeth over the sink. I haven't done that. It's been a year and a month since I've been able to stand at a sink in a mirror and brush my teeth. That's a big deal for me.
Also a big deal, getting on a ski lift for the first time in his life.
Two, three, lift, and back. You're on, thank you.
Here we go, buddy. Have a great run.
It's a bright, sunny morning as the chairlift climbs a few hundred feet to the top of the bunny slope.
I really enjoyed the view. I've never done that before. We can do that again, can't we?
Bland usually gets around in a wheelchair, but today he's on a monoski, a bucket seat mounted on a single ski. Mike McGregor is his volunteer instructor.
I want to keep your eyes up, looking forward. Okay. All right, if you look down at the snow or like to see what these things are doing, you tend to lose your balance. All right? And if you need me to stop,
don't stop. Or...
Okay, look over at Joan. Easy. Hey, perfect. Now look over at Megan. Don't lean.
There you go.
All right.
I did it, though. Uh-oh. You can't be scared to fall.
At the bottom of the slope, Bland's cousin, Terrence James, is waiting with a camera.
Hey, I wouldn't have never thought he would have came out to Pennsylvania to go skiing. I ain't going skiing, but as he's falling down, I'm taking all the pictures and I'm going to make sure Mama, Grandma, everybody else get to see the pictures.
This past year hasn't been an easy one for Brandon Bland. He was partially paralyzed below the ribs.
Happened on December 3rd in 2012.
It was just after midnight at a club on U Street in Northwest DC.
As we exited the club, the guy just started shooting. He was shooting at the target, and I guess I must have been standing near the guy.
Wrong place at the wrong time. A bullet struck Bland in the back.
Well, at first, you had to get in your mind that you're in a wheelchair first, and then after that, it's a little defeating, for the lack of a better word.
He's been working with therapists at the MedStar National Rehabilitation Hospital in D.C., regaining movement and confidence.
Now I'm starting to, venture out like this. I would have never did this a couple of months ago. Even though I was getting better, I still would have never even came to this trip. I would have made an excuse with myself. Well, he always called me, come out, you know, and I never do it.
I've been trying to get him to clubs and go to a mall, get out the house. He don't want to do that.
You get in depressed modes, but you got to just pick yourself up. At first, like I said, I was probably my worst enemy, but now you got to motivate yourself.
At the age of 14, I was electrocuted while playing on top of a train, boxcar, just being a silly kid, and got too close to an overhead power wire.
Reggie Showers had both legs amputated below the knee when he was 14. Now he's a registered snowboarding instructor and one of the dozens of volunteers teaching people with disabilities on this recent morning. Showers walks and snowboards on prosthetic legs.
Never let the amputation stop me from achieving some of the goals that I wanted to achieve in life.
Goals like racing motorcycles.
As a career professionally for probably over 20 years.
When he first tried snowboarding at a resort in the Pocono Mountains, there was no specialized adaptive program for people like him. He had to figure things out on his own.
My leg popped off a couple times. People were screaming and hollering because they didn't know I was an amputee. They go, oh my God, he lost his leg,
Keeping your prosthetic leg on is, perhaps no surprise, not that easy.
So there's little things that me as an amputee snowboard instructor knows through experience, through trial and error, that I can offer to the new snowboarder, the new adaptive snowboarder.
On this recent morning, there are more than 50 people with disabilities going up and down the slopes here at Liberty Mountain. These 2 days of adaptive skiing instruction are put on by the group Baltimore Adaptive Sports and Recreation.
My name is Pamela Leonard. I am the executive director of Baltimore Adaptive Recreation and Sports.
Leonard is a recreation therapist, and she's put on this skiing event each year for the past 15 years. She says it's not just about skiing.
Oh, I think it transcends into everyday life. You're successful here. You feel like, and I don't like the word normal, but you feel just like a person, like everybody else.
Back on the slopes, Brandon Bland is still getting the hang of things.
Don't focus on the little kids. Yeah, Look away from the trees.
And then I seen that red thing, I got nervous.
Ready to go up again?
Yeah.
Bland's cousin, Terrence James, has been watching the whole time, and he says he's proud. So is Bland.
I'm proud of myself. I was going to back out, to be honest.
Run after run, fall after fall, he doesn't want to quit.
I want to keep going, like, I knew they had to take a lunch break, and he was probably getting tired of picking me up. But I'd do it again, of course.
I'm Jacob Fenston.
Like the people we just heard from, the man we'll meet next also suffered a devastating injury. One summer day in 2013, while Rockville resident Mike LeBrun was out riding his bike, he hit a pothole. His back struck the concrete at a 90-degree angle, and he suffered massive internal injuries. In the end, Mike survived, but he was paralyzed from the chest down. Mike's daughter Kate is 14 and attends Walter Johnson High School in Montgomery County. Back in October, she sat down with her dad to ask some questions she'd never before posed about the accident and how it changed their lives.
On the day of your accident, I was having my big first swim meet, and you were biking to meet us there, and then the accident happened. For a long time, I blamed myself because I thought it was my fault you were out that day. Who do you blame?
I don't blame anybody, Kate. I woke up that Saturday morning after having ridden to and from work on Friday, and I had that post-exercise stiffness in my legs, and I wanted to work that out. So that's why I decided to ride my bike that day. And the rest, as they say, is history. I hit the pothole, and now I am what I am.
I've always loved playing soccer with you in the backyard, and you helping me out with my technique. We really don't get to do that much anymore, and it's really hard sometimes. What do you really miss doing that we could do before?
Exactly what you just said. I miss being able to go out in the backyard or go to the park and play soccer with you and with your brother and sister, and being able to, you know, not just critique your technique, but being able to show it and be able to play with you guys. But what I love is all the things we can still do. That's just too awesome.
I remember right after your accident going to the hospital to see you. There were some times that I was really scared, really, really scared. Did you ever think you wouldn't come home?
There were times when I was, especially right away, when I wasn't sure what the outcome of this was going to be. You know, I knew I was really, really hurt, and I was scared, Kate. I was really scared. But once the surgery was done and I had recovered enough to know what was going on, I was pretty confident that everything was going to be okay. And then there was the night when you and your brother and sister came to the hospital after coming back from camp, and you found me in the emergency room just having had a chest tube put in. And I didn't know it at the time. I am covered in blood. The sheets are covered in blood. It's just a great big bloody mess. And you did not freak out. You didn't even let on even the slightest sign that it was some kind of Halloween horror story. And that made me incredibly proud of you for that.
When we went to Japan over spring break, I noticed there were a lot of people, especially children, who were staring at you, and that happens a lot here too. I know you like being kind of an advocate for, you know, your whole situation, but does it ever like really bother you that people stare?
Being the center of attention is not normally my thing. And you're right, when we were in Japan, I can't remember the little boy's name, but he was so upfront and candid and asked, why are you on wheels? And why don't your legs work? And I realized people were curious. They want to know what it's like. And so I see part of my responsibility now is to be an advocate for the disabled. In a lot of ways, just by living my life the way that I want to and showing how much you can do. Because one moment I was perfectly able-bodied and the next moment I wasn't. I think I can be example to people about how you can live with a disability. While it changes your life, it doesn't diminish your life. And that's become very important to me.
What do you think our life would be like if you hadn't gotten hurt?
I think it would have been much like it is now. I mean, the limitations that I face because of my disability, they haven't changed the story arc of our lives that much. And you're still the same person that you were before. I'm still the same person I was before. So we've had to change the way we do things. You have to help me more, so you've had to grow up a little bit faster. I hope you've learned that things in life can change very, very quickly, and that even major changes like this don't stop everything.
Thank you for talking to me and answering all my questions. That was really nice.
It was easy, Kate. I'm more than happy to do it. I love you very much.
Love you too, Daddy.
This story was produced by WAMU special correspondent Kavitha Cardoza.
Support for education reporting on WAMU 88.5 comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Our next story takes us back to D.C., albeit in a top-secret, surreptitious kind of way. Let's let environment reporter Jonathan Wilson take it from here.
We meet downtown, not far from the day's target destination, a souvenir shop on 10th Street. Standing on the street corner at lunchtime, Kate, just Kate, she won't let us give you her last name, is wearing a maroon business casual dress and a thin beige shawl. She doesn't stand out, and that is by design. She's working at one of the coolest jobs in city government.
So I'm an undercover inspector.
Of course, DC has lots of inspectors, but Kate says her undercover gig is pretty unique.
I'm basically like a professional secret shopper.
Secret or mystery shoppers, in case you're unfamiliar, are those people that retailers pay to shop at their stores to make sure employees are doing everything by the book. The practice has been around for decades, if not longer. But Kate's job only became necessary in January of 2010. That's when DC rolled out its so-called bag tax, a first-in-the-nation 5-cent fee on plastic bags. It's aimed at discouraging consumers and businesses from using so many of the bags and reducing the amount of trash in local rivers and streams.
My job is to go and ensure that businesses are charging the fee consistently and that they're also distributing compliant bags.
A do-gooder with a hidden identity. Sound familiar? Batman? Superwoman? Could Kate be the hero for tough times like ours?
No, I've never thought of it that way.
Well, before we get carried away, and we will get carried away, let's go over how Kate's sting operations actually work. She walks into any of the more than 5,000 establishments subject to the law, posing as just another consumer, and purchases something, making sure to ask the cashier for a bag. Not exactly mission impossible, but we're still going to play the music. We walk up the stairs to that 10th Street souvenir shop. I start to look around, doing my best to play the part of a curious shopper, but Kate, with the kind of confidence that only comes from experience, cuts right to the chase, grabbing a granola bar.
Can we get a bag for that?
The cashier reaches back to a stash of plastic bags hanging on the wall behind him, flashing a friendly and unsuspecting smile. I can barely contain my excitement, but before I can blow our cover, Kate delivers the coup de grace.
Can I get a receipt, please?
Did they charge you?
Let's see.
So I had asked for a bag. Let's see. He did not.
If you're expecting some sort of confrontation, that's not what Kate's job is about. Plus, that would blow her cover.
They never know that I just purchased something from their store, so I don't actually confront them. Everything is actually done through the mail, and then I usually get a call from the business once they've received their enforcement action.
She's even careful about how she pays at the store she's inspecting.
There's no government credit card. I use my own money, and then I get reimbursed.
Kate says her predecessor in the job came up with the scheme and even came up with a way to make sure all those little food purchases made during the undercover operations do some good on their own.
Whatever I purchase, it's usually a non-perishable good. We then donate to senior centers across the city. So every month or two, once we've gathered up enough goods from our inspections, I drive it over to a senior center, and seniors across the city get a bunch of goodies from the inspections.
After an initial warning, repeat offenders get hit with a $100 fine, an amount that doubles after each additional violation, with $800 being the maximum. The fees are raising about $2 million a year. That's money that goes towards stream restoration and environmental education, although the amount has come under fire from some anti-tax and government spending watchdog groups. But the city has added quite a few new grocery stores in recent years and is currently gaining about 1,000 new residents each month. So Kate says the fact that fine revenue is staying level is actually a sign that people are starting to forego the plastic. That trend is also reflected in the fact that stream cleanup volunteers are reporting a 60% reduction in the amount of plastic bags found in the water.
And the point of the law is never to raise money. The point has always been behavior change and getting people to use fewer disposable bags and turn to reusable bags. But we think it's great that, you know, despite all this growth in the city, new businesses, people aren't using more bags, they're actually using fewer bags.
This story, by the way, will self-destruct in 5 seconds. You'll still be able to find it on the web. I'm Jonathan Wilson.
In a minute...
Screaming girls. Lots of screaming girls.
We go back 50 years to the day Washington got its first taste of Beatlemania. It's coming your way as Metro Connection continues on WAMU 88.5. Welcome back to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and we'll kick off this part of the show with a story we did in February 2014 about a particular day in February 1964. February 11th, to be exact. Roughly 8 inches of snow covered the ground, and temperatures were bottoming out in the low 20s. But that didn't stop 8,092 Washingtonians, primarily screaming female teenagers, from trekking to the Washington Coliseum in Northeast D.C. to experience this.
This is Harold James, and now from the Washington, D.C. Coliseum, the world's most exciting group, Capitol recording stars, the Beatles!
Indeed, 2 days after making their debut on The Ed Sullivan Show, the Beatles performed their first full North American concert here in the nation's capital. After several opening acts, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr entered a ropeless boxing rink smack dab in the middle of the Coliseum's floor and played for about 35 minutes. But how is it that Washington, D.C. came to host this momentous event?
With a love like that, you know you should.
Well, to find out, we have to go back to late 1963, when CBS aired the first American news story about the Beatles. It was filed by London correspondent Alexander Kendrick.
Yeah. Those are the Beatles, those are. And this is Beatleland, formerly known as Britain, where an epidemic called Beatlemania has seized the teenage population, especially female.
About 2 days later, I got a letter from a listener, Marcia Albert, 15 years old, Sligo Junior High School. She said, "I saw this on television the other night, and if these guys are so great, why can't we hear their music here?"
This is WWDC disc jockey Carol James from a 1984 interview with WWDC's successor, DC 101. James wound up emceeing the Coliseum concert in February of 64. But back in December of 63, when he read Marsha Albert's plea for the Beatles, he said to himself,
"Well, there's nothing we won't do for our listeners at WWDC. So in 1 or 2 days, we had hand-carried by a stewardess this Parlophone record from England of I Want to Hold Your Hand. And I asked Marsha to come in and introduce it, since she was the one who started the whole thing. I wrote out a little introduction for her, and I had handwritten it out on the back of a traffic report. Accident at 2nd and T Northeast, two vehicles involved, you know. And so she read the introduction to the first Beatle record in the United States.
So Marsha Albert of Dublin Drive of Silver Spring has the honor of introducing something brand new and exclusive here at WWDC. Marsha, the microphone here on the Carol James Show is yours.
Ladies and gentlemen, for the first time on the air in the United States, here are the Beatles singing I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Now, once the folks at the Beatles label, Capitol Records, caught wind of this unofficial airing, Carol James says they were pretty peeved.
The people at Capitol Records in New York later told me that they were going to get an injunction against us.
But it wasn't long before they realized they had a major hit on their hands. So they moved the song's official U.S. release date up from January 13th, 1964, to shortly after Christmas, 1963.
Let me be your man, and please say to me,
Not long after that, Beatles manager Brian Epstein called up Harry Lynn, owner of the Washington Coliseum, and asked if the band could perform there. It would be the largest venue they'd ever played. Lynn had never actually heard of the Beatles, but he said yes and ran an ad, just one ad, in the Washington Post.
And tickets were $2, $3, and $4.
Tom Carrico was among the lucky ones who saw that ad and managed to nab tickets. He was 13 years old.
And you do the math, you can figure out just exactly what kind of a card-carrying geezer I am now.
I recently met the Bethesda, Maryland native inside the Coliseum, near 3rd and M Streets Northeast, not far from the train tracks.
So, retracing that night, we had a huge snowstorm, and the Beatles had to take the train down from New York instead of fly.
They arrived at Union Station at 3:10 p.m., much to the delight of the 2,000 screaming fans who'd braved the weather to see the lads from Liverpool. The band then hit the Coliseum for a sound check, and as Tom Carrico remembers, for some wintertime fun.
I mean, if you look at some of the photos, you can see them playing out in the snow, throwing snowballs in the parking lot. You know, we probably had a foot of snow. Which, you know what a foot of snow does to this town now. Well, imagine 50 years ago.
This is the picture they took in that yard across the street. Yeah, I watched them when they filmed these pictures.
They're playing in the snow.
Yes, they're playing in the snow.
Naomi Banks has been living on 3rd Street Northeast, directly across from the Washington Coliseum, for decades.
I've been here since 1954 or 1953. It's been a while.
And during those decades, she's compiled a scrapbook from the many events held at the Coliseum, originally known as the U-Line Ice Arena.
Stevie Wonder played over there. Paul Robeson sang there. I got a picture of that somewhere.
You do?
Yes. Clipping. I mean, it was just so many people.
But the most memorable people, she says, had to be the Beatles. She was 16 and got to see much of their concert before her parents made her come home.
This man from Texas, he got the original copy of this. These are the songs they played.
So John Lennon wrote out that list of songs they played, and you have it.
Yes. Well, I have a copy. He has the original one.
The songs are scribbled on stationery from the Shoreham Hotel, where the Beatles had booked the entire 7th floor for the night. The story goes that when one family on that floor refused to relocate, the Shoreham cut off their hot water, electricity, and heating, claiming a power failure. So after the Fab Four checked in, they returned to the Coliseum for a press conference. Then it was on with the show. And then 16-year-old Columbia, Maryland resident Michael Oberman was there.
Well, I just remember that because of the way the Coliseum was set up and the stage was in the center, when I first got there, I thought, oh my gosh, some people are never going to be able to see the front of the Beatles. but they actually moved around on stage and moved the drum set and turned so that the entire audience could get to see them at one time or another. As I remember, it was a pretty frenetic and short set. It was maybe 35 minutes, and it was hit after hit.
Indeed, as the crowd lovingly pelted the band with flashbulbs and jelly beans, a confection said to be the fella's favorite, they performed a dozen hits. From I Saw Her Standing There,
one, two, three,
to This Boy.
The next song is a track off our Capitol album, and it's called This Boy.
To the tune that got the whole ball rolling, I Want to Hold Your Hand.
This next song that we'd like to sing, before we do it, we'd like to thank everybody here in America, Washington, America, we'd like to thank everybody for buying this particular record and starting this thing off in America and giving us the chance to come here and see you all in Washington. Thank you. Song.
This audio, by the way, is from a black-and-white CBS video of the concert, later shown as a closed-circuit broadcast in many venues, including the Coliseum. Thing is, though, while these clips sound decently clear, folks who were there that night, like Michael Oberman, Naomi Banks, and Tom Carrico, they'll readily admit they could barely hear the music.
This was the days before there were real music venues in D.C., so you had to settle for places like the Coliseum. And the Coliseum was probably the worst place in Washington for music. It was a big cement barn.
It was pandemonium in there. I mean, kids screaming, hollering, crying. I think they was out screaming the music.
It was a feeling in the room, like an explosion. You know, I've been to probably thousands of concerts. I'm in the music business now. I managed the Nighthawks in the 70s here and was their booking agent as well for a long time. And there's nothing I've experienced quite like that night.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Years later, when Paul McCartney was asked what he remembers from that first North American show, he said, I don't remember thinking we played particularly well, but looking back, time has been very kind to us. It was a cool gig. The great thing about memories is that the good bits are the ones that tend to remain. The trip to Washington is a very romantic time in my memory. Did you attend that Beatles concert at the Coliseum back in 1964? If so, we would love to hear your memories. You can reach us at metro@wamu.org. So back in 1964, the same year the Beatles came to town, a man named Lawrence Guyot was working as a leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Mississippi. During his time in the South, as he fought for civil rights, he was beaten and imprisoned more times than he could count. But he helped push for the seminal Voting Rights Act of 1965. Now, politically, it was difficult for Guyot to stay in Mississippi. So at the behest of his friend, fellow Mississippi native Marion Barry, Guyot headed to Washington. And until his death 2 years ago, Guyot was still organizing for civil rights in the district. A few months back, Lauren Ober sat down with Guyot's daughter, Julie Guyot D'Angone, to discuss her father and what it's like to be a child of the civil rights movement.
So for people who don't know your dad, why don't you describe him for us?
He's a force of nature. He is often described as courageous, fearless. He takes up a lot of space. When Guyot's in the room, you know it, you know, it's not a secret. He had a resounding voice.
There is no more progressive, creative, or organized civil rights movement anywhere in America other than Mississippi. Where else did a movement conduct its own election? Where else could a movement in a freedom election got 80,000 people to participate in it? We couldn't bring Mississippi into the country, but we could bring the country into Mississippi and get the federal government to understand and get the America to understand that the disenfranchisement done by Mississippi was done because they allowed it to happen.
You know, GIAT means to be really hard-headed about something that you believe in and work for it fervently. It's to sometimes be unlikable, but to be utterly unshakable in knowing the difference between what's right and wrong.
What kind of father was he?
A non-traditional one. He took me seriously. He took us seriously. And as intellects, as individuals, and I don't remember any baby talk. All of our lullabies were freedom songs, you know. Dad was authentic. That is how he viewed the world. And it was through a lens of constant, vigilant struggle. Yeah, told people what to do. But my dad was very gracious in leaving a lot of room for intellectual exploration at home. He didn't tell me what to do. He never told me an idea that I had to have. He didn't tell me that I had to think a certain way or believe in a certain thing. You know, he didn't tell me I had to vote. I had to vote. You know, you need a ride, you know, whatever, we're gonna vote. You know, where's your sticker? I voted today. Where is it? I had to vote.
Registering to vote at that time meant that you filled out a 22-question questionnaire. One of the questions was, interpret any of the 286 sections of the Mississippi Constitution to the satisfaction of the registrar. Now, you have to bear in mind that some of those registrars couldn't read or write, but that didn't matter. They could still determine who should be registered if that person happened to be black, because all whites who attempted to register were registered.
So Dad and Giat were two different people?
Oh, yeah. I can't say what I want to say, but you know, you don't mess with Giat. You fill that in however you need to. But Dad, you can talk to all day long.
How much of your father's work was talked about at home, or was it just a part of your everyday life?
It was definitely part of everyday life. My dad would say everything is political. We're talking about a man who went to a dear friend's birthday party, not with flowers or with a nice Chardonnay, but with a book list of readings that all politically minded people should be reading. And it was endearing. It was very much who he was.
Your father, obviously, during his time in Mississippi, growing up in Jim Crow South, dealt with a lot of things that we don't deal with in terms of violence. And I'm wondering if he talked about that at home, if you were aware of his experience of being in prison, being beaten. Did he talk at all about that, or was that sort of left at the front door?
Okay, context. I didn't know that going to jail was a bad thing, just because every good person I know has been to jail. One of the stories about my mother was, you know, they had all of the flatware taken away because they were banging on the cell bars, making music and singing freedom songs. And so that was taken away. You know, my mom would say, you know, if Dad was grumpy, we're talking about a man who endured a beating where he stood up the whole time. There's something in that. He stood up the whole time. You know, stories of resilience and courage and fearlessness and Giat are shared in those tiny little details.
That was Julie Giat Diangone, daughter of civil rights leader Lawrence Giat, talking with Metro Connection's Lauren Ober.
Ain't gonna let nobody do it. Turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let nobody do it. Turn me round, keep on a walking, keep on a talking, marching up to freedom.
And that's Metro Connection for this week and for this year. We heard from WAMU's Emily Berman, Jonathan Wilson, Kavitha Cardoza, Jacob Fenston, and Lauren Ober. WAMU's Managing Editor of News is Memo Lyons. Metro Connection's Managing Producer is Tara Boyle. Lauren Landau is our Editorial Assistant. Thanks, as always, to the WAMU engineering and digital media teams for their help with production and MetroConnection.org. Our theme song, Every Little Bit Hurts, is from the album It Was Easy by Tidal Tracks and used with permission of the Ernest Jennings Record Company. You can find information about all the music we play on MetroConnection.org. You can also find a link to our free weekly podcast. We're also on iTunes and the NPR News app. We hope you can join us next week when we'll bring you a favorite show from 2014, Behind Closed Doors. We'll talk with a former White House butler about life at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. We'll tour some of the secret spots at Union Station that travelers rarely see. And we'll find out why many local musicians are skipping the stage and opting for smaller venues, much smaller venues.
I think you want to see what's going on in DC music, you should be going to house shows.
I'm Rebecca Shear, wishing you a Happy New Year from all of us here at Metro Connection, a production of WAMU 88.5 News.